Blog Talk Radio. This podcast is brought to you by the Phantom Gallery Chicago Network, an artist-run project that exhibits in non-traditional gallery settings. The Phantom Gallery looks at how the city influences art and how artists transform the city by contributing to civic dialogue and quality of life. These installations produce creative conversations. I'm your host, Alpha Bhutan. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to another podcast on Creative Conversation. Today we have on the line with us Solo Beverly. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine. Looking forward to our conversation. And we also have on the line gallery owner and co-curator Rose Cannon. Hi, Rose.
Hi there, everybody. How are you?
Well, we're going to get right into the conversation because sometimes a half an hour goes really fast. And we're going to ask Solo, am I saying your name right? Right,
it's
Solo?
Solo. Solo. S-H-O-L-O. Yeah.
Great. What I want you to do is talk about yourself and your trajectory in your art career.
Okay. Where should I start? Well, I guess I've always been an artist. From a child. My mom was an interior decorator and passionate about gardening and all things color. So I started at a very young age drawing. In fact, I used to always get in trouble for kissing walls because I would make faces after putting my lips on the walls. So that kind of led into me getting a pad and a pen and like, what a concept. So let's see, I did art all through high school, and then after I graduated, I went away to school, which did not work well for me because all I wanted to do was art. So after that, I ended up at Columbia for a year while I was working on my portfolio to get into the Art Institute. So the Art Institute is where I ended up, and I started out in sculpture. I've always loved figure sculpture, which led me to watercolor, and now I am a mixed media artist. I'm still very passionate about watercolor, but I'm more mixed media with collage, and lately it's been murals, which I love painting big, so that's kind of something I'm doing right now. So that's it.
So tell me a little bit about your experience at the School of the Art Institute. I attended there with my in the Masters of Art Administration program.
Oh, okay, great. It was an experience for me. First of all, I was the only person of color in my area where I was. At least I thought I was. Like, I do not remember seeing very many people of color there. And my whole thing about art school is like, do you really need it? No. You know, because in the end, it's like you come out of there like I did, and you can't get a job unless you're in a certain kind of field. I shouldn't say you shouldn't go to art school, but it's a whatever department you're trying to be in or skill set. You know, I just wanted to draw and paint, where I probably should have gone more into marketing, where I could use, you know, learn more about the computer and do that. But basically when I was there, it was all about abstract art. And as much as I admire it, like, my brain doesn't go there. So I kind of
it's all about the notion. It's all about the notion of deconstructing what you already know, and then reconstructing, and that's the model that's used not only in the undergraduate work, but I found that true as in the more elite forms of like art administration.
Mm-hmm.
We deconstruct what you already know, and if you already come in with a sense of self, that deconstruction doesn't really work for you.
But it also is just, you know, a process, you know, and what the School of the Art Institute is known for with Bauhaus and that whole movement. So.
Yeah, I'm not crashing it at all. I loved, you know, walking over that bridge every day and walking through the museum. You know, the other thing that I faced is I was working 3 jobs while I was in school because my parents were not interested in helping me to go to art school. They just didn't even, it's like, what are you doing? And so I think I kind of missed the experience that most people get when they're at college, because it's like, you know, you got 8 weeks to do this assignment. I do it on the 7th week because I was working, you know. And so I didn't have what most people's experiences might be at in college, period. So I did have a great art community. I lived with like 10 artists. We painted every night. We, you know, so I do remember that being fun.
And I think that those are, you know, our takeaways. You know, I enjoy education, and I am an educator, you know, and an administrator, so I really kind of enjoy what I did and the challenge of what I did. But you, me like yourself, I found myself being the only African-American, and I was 45 at the time, in those courses and in those classes. And I'm like, you know, I had to take a stance, like, you know, I can't be sitting here representing the entire African American, you know, race when you want to play the race card in a classroom, and I got to defend and do that. I just came here to try to do what I need to do to get out of here. But you can't take that look, because then you begin, you have to say it out loud, and then you begin to, you know, I was always having to make sure that I'm 2 steps ahead, my presentations were sharper, you know, and then it's just a lot of dynamics that happen. But I never discourage people from exploring that and the life style of becoming an artist and what art colonies are like, you know, and that's the part of education that we have to remember, because the most of the education that happens is outside of that classroom. And like you said, you really enjoyed, you know, the collectiveness of being in that colony amongst other artists. So what we're going to do now is go into talking about you as the artist that painted the Black Lives Matter mural at the Evanston Arts Center. And when asked about racism and how it connects to intergenerational and collective trauma, you know, I wanted you to speak about that and what you were going through at that time when you painted the Black Lives Matter mural at the center. And I am correct, you live in Evanston.
No, I don't. I live in Deerfield.
Same thing.
What?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
She lives in Deerfield.
Okay.
Yeah. I did live in Evanston for many years. What?
Tell us a little bit about Deerfield and how it's different than Evanston.
Oh, gosh, where do I even start? I mean, Deerfield is its own little planet. We literally are a planet up here. And it has a big barrier around it. So I practically should say I live in Evanston, because I don't do anything up here. I'm either in Evanston or in the city. And that is when Rose presented the mural to me, that's why I was all over it, because something like that is so far-fetched to being up here. And so I want to back it up to, you asked what was going on with me when this mural became a subject, and I had just done a huge spur-of-the-moment Black Lives Matter march in Deerfield. Because we weren't doing anything. And a few suburbs north of us, Lake Forest, had even planned for a march. And I said, so what's up? Why isn't Deerfield doing anything? Why are we not supporting this? I know I'm the token Black, so I guess I'm just going to have to do it. And So we ended up having a very peaceful, successful march up here, and it kind of woke everybody up. We've done two more gatherings since then, but we're starting to fall back asleep again. So that's a whole nother subject that I'm going to be, you know, later on down the road. But once I was presented with the Evanston mural, and I've always been a part of the Evanston Art Center. I love coming down there and taking classes. And I knew that it was, you know, there are parts of Evanston that borderline on being separate planets too. And so that's why I was like, okay, this is good. We have to do this, specifically because of the area it's in. And so, when I was gathering the artists together for it, it's like we were all just so passionate with just being a part of this project. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And who are the other artists that came out and helped?
Oh my God, I'm going to draw it. We had artist Z, Baz, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank on everybody's names right
now. David Niari. And Boz Cumberbatch, of course, you mentioned.
Yeah, we have Boz.
And there was another girl. She had a Latinx name, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's who I'm trying to remember her name. I had never met any of these artists before this. They were all referred to me, and I put messages out on Facebook, and that was also part of it. Like, I don't want to know the artist. I want to meet new artists. I want to know what they're passionate about, and they just came running. They loved it.
Actually, I think you had met Boz before. You met the 11. Right, you knew Boz.
Yeah, I knew that Boz.
But
with that body of artists that you pull together, when we talk about intergenerational and collective trauma, you know, could you talk about what that looks like and what that felt like while you all were working?
You know, it was like we were kind of taken over by an outer energy, if that makes sense. I mean, I know, you know, since the Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, I have kind of been in, everything's been kind of a blur, but I'm being guided. And it's something that's been, we were all just really driven. And there was, when we sat and talked about it, it was like one of the things we said is like, here we are in Evanston, and like, how can I put this? Some of the artists didn't even know that the art gallery existed, and they're like, you know, how are Black artists being represented in this area, in this gallery? And so I think there was kind of a drive there too to just be a part of something new that they didn't know about. We all were extremely frustrated, even though it was very nice people walking by and saying thank you, but for some reason we felt a sense of like frustration with that. Because we weren't quite sure why people were saying thank you, and like, this is great that you guys are doing this. We kind of felt, I can't really explain it, but we all were just kind of driven by this force to like, if we could have painted that entire parking lot, we would have.
Yes.
You know, and in the beginning, we kind of had some restrictions on us. And I quickly said, you cannot bring a bunch of artists of color in here and restrict them with this. You know, we only want to portray love and peace. Nobody's coming in here with anything else. So it's like, we cannot have these boundaries.
So what were some of the boundaries that were put in place for you?
Well, they wanted everybody to send in what their letter was going to be. What were they going to paint inside the letter? And right there I was like, they don't even know what the space looks like yet. Nobody knows what letter they're going to choose. And I think it has to be something that's very present. You know, once the artists get here and they get a feel for the other artists and we're all together, I feel like that's when it's going to happen. So one or two artists had stuff that was prepared. I actually did a bunch of sketches, and I did not do any of it when I got there. It completely changed when we got there. So that was one thing where I was like, you can't put that kind of boundary on us.
So I'm hearing you struggling with the terminology of trauma, you know, and with dealing with racism. And so why is that a struggle? What has happened in your generations before you that has caused you to, you know, like I said, you can't put a finger on it, you can't really express it, you don't know what to say about it, but there's something in the transference of trauma from one generation to another generation that has been a part of the African American and the Black experience here in this country. And we always talk about, you know, some generations talk about Willie Lynch letter, and then the newer generations are like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're switching into this whole conversation that centers around, you know, what collective trauma is.
Can I remind Sholo of something? Sholo, you have a beautiful story about who was it? Is it the uncle that helped settle the Black settlement there in Deerfield? And I find it an extraordinarily poignant story, and it would fit right in here as your intergenerational effect. If you want to tell it.
No,
sure.
Thank you for, because that's something we're still working on. But my uncle and aunt in 1966 were the first Black family to move to Deerfield. And they were both educators. My aunt taught at a school in Highland Park for 35 years, and my uncle started out in Highland Park, but then eventually ended up in the city at a college. But we're now in the process of trying to, back in the time when they moved here, there was a plot of land that is now called Mitchell Park that my uncle and aunt and a few other people wanted to have housing built. Integrative housing. And so a bunch of people in the area, long story short, were against it. And overnight, this man, Mitchell, ended up building a park on the piece of property. So the village, the township of Deerfield, there are several people who feel, my family as well, because of their fight for this, they feel the park should be named after my uncle and aunt. So the board is actually, they just met, I think a week ago. So we're, you know, there's a small little petition that goes out. We're posting about it everywhere. And so now we're just waiting to hear what their decision has been. But in the meanwhile, the trauma part of it is that this community, Deerfield, still continues to protect this man who they feel built several parks in Deerfield just so that the community could stay safe and have several places for families to go and to commune together. Meanwhile, you've done a great job of keeping, you know, people of color, Black people, out of Deerfield. So I would say my collective trauma right now is that both of my parents worked so hard to get us up here and to raise us. And there, you know, there was a couple of times where I thought my parents would either get killed or they would burn our house down. And it's just something where we dealt with it and moved on. And now it's all, on top of everything else going on, it's just all come to a head with me. And so, I need to find a place. I need to find a place to, I do it through my art, and now I've become kind of a staunch activist, which is a whole different realm for me. So I'm basically still learning myself, but I think I have dealt with a lot of racism, but my dad taught me that it's not always about you and that some people just don't want us here and you need to just keep moving. So that's kind of how I've been growing up here. And now it's kind of not okay. Like I need to let you know that it's not okay now.
And I applaud you, you know, for that and for that story and sharing that with us, because, you know, I was not present here. I was in Muskoka, Illinois, when the protest happened, and then the looting, and then, you know, and in turn looting, and those kind of demonstrations were going on, and they're still going on here in the city of Chicago. But I am back in Bronzeville, and during that that time, the gallery that I'm represented by, Gallery Gachard, and the Bronzeville Artist Loft, they were out in front, you know, with signs saying, "Hey, Black Lives Matter, this is a Black-owned business," and then they had to stand out there and protect, you know, what we've built here, in terms of a place where we're transforming community. We're not gentrifying, we're transforming community here in Bronzeville.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched from afar my friends, you know, as fellow artists out on the front line dealing with activism and dealing with and empowering, you know, the artists that live and work, you know, and invest in community here in Bronzeville. And that's the same how I feel about, I was asked the question about why am I doing a fellowship in Evanston when there's so much work that needs to be done here. And I'm looking like, I just was stunned by someone asking me that question. And I've always felt like even before the School of the Art Institute and any other universities I've attended, why are you placing me as a role model in only an African-American school so I could be the role model for little African-American children as an artist? How come I can't be that same role model that transforms the way people think and see us in another school that's predominantly white? You know, I was always resistant to that. And feeling that, you know, you're placing me, I grew up in a very diverse background, and so now you're trying to place me and fit me into a peg, into a, you know what I mean, a piece of puzzle that this is okay for you to get this far in your career, but how come I can't mainstream, and how come I can't do other things in other communities to let other, you know what I mean? I have to be that intergenerational person that is kind of looking past this trauma, you know, and where I fit in the rest of the world.
Okay.
You know, so.
Absolutely, Alpha. And, that drives me. That's why I wanted to do this business here in Evanston. Evanston is maybe one step, I don't know if we're maybe a little bit more progressive than Deerfield is. My son, daughter-in-law, and my grandchildren live up there. And I think what struck me is that you said, Sholo, that some people asked you that they didn't even know a thing about the Evanston Art Center. They didn't even know it existed in Evanston. Mm-hmm. And that's what I always grappled with as I was trying to start my art gallery, is that here you have this beautiful art center and that our people did not feel welcome there. And I'm
right.
not sure whether they feel welcome yet there and stuff. But I was happy that they brought Alpha on board. And I think that, you know, that she will, you know, what she's working on will tend to bring more people of color into
right.
the
Again, I did tell you that I'm living and working here in Bronzeville. And for a lot of, you know, neighbors, when we do our trolley tours, which is always on the third Friday of each month in the summer, and now we've expanded it to December and we're on virtually online, having open uh-huh. studios, there was a sense of, I don't know if I can come in there. What do I do? When people from the neighborhood wanted to come into the gallery, they didn't, or be a part of the trolley, they didn't know how to interact with us as artists, even though we're African-American
oh, wow.
artists. Because mm-hmm. just like you said, your parents didn't want
right.
to support you right. as an artist going to art school, and you had to manage on your own. If you want to do that, you're not going to make no money, go ahead on.
Right.
I'm not going to pay
right.
for it,
right?
Right. And so
right, right.
intergenerationally, I got the same message, but nothing deterred me because my parents invested in me and they knew, you know, that I was an artist and that was something that I always did. So I was
right.
born with that spirit of an artist and it wasn't deflected. It was other people around that tried to deflect and control
mm-hmm.
my narrative and it didn't happen that way that I let them. But here, even in an African-American community, you have that divide of eliteness of the arts are not for us and we don't know what to do and they're doing something different and here those artists are coming and they're bringing another world mm. into this world.
Right.
You know? And that's part
right.
of the activism work that we do. And I think that my last question for, because we have a few minutes left on this call, is to talk to you about what your social responsibility is in an ever-changing world. And here we are faced with, again, you know, public policy, Black Lives Matter, art and activism, you know, and talk about what your role is in that going forward.
You know, I am being led by my ancestors right now. I mean, I'm going hardcore. I just did a training for Wall of Moms. So that's something I'm getting involved with. Also, I just cannot stop doing art, and I really feel like, you know, I'm on a path now where I just want to do installation murals and kind of go guerrilla and just leave them places to just. I'm a firm believer that when people see something visually, it changes a space. It changes your headspace, even if it's just for 2 seconds. You know, it's something that you saw.
Absolutely.
I want it to make an impact on you. You know, one of the things that I've been experiencing is, and I've never been a person that, as an artist, that says, oh, I want to be in a gallery. Well, I just did a gallery show, two gallery shows, in the last month, and the feedback's been nice, but I don't know if you guys have been seeing the articles, how some Black artists are feeling used, misinterpreted,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're the rave now, and it's kind of like, and I talk to my Black friends, and I talk to my white friends, like, how should we be feeling right now about this? And it's like, you know what? I can't even worry about that. If there's a positive feedback coming, then I'm going to do it. But I was in a very weird space, like, oh, now the white galleries want my work in there, and they want it right now because. But that's one of my things, too, because this show that I was in, they asked me to be in it. I said,
this,
oh, I can't wait to meet all the other artists of color.
Artist-run project.
Hello?
Yeah, we're still here. We're ending, wrapping it up.
I couldn't wait to meet the other artists of color, and they said, well, you're the only one.
And
quality.
And I was like, that's crazy. There's no way I can be the one that represents the entire black race. And so that's kind of my thing, too. Like, we need to get, you know, more artists of color out there.
We will.
And we'll continue this conversation, and we can do a part two of this conversation. But our episode has ended, and thank you both for joining me on this call, Creative Conversations.
Thank you.